From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
How are you, Joyce?
I'm doing well, Preet. How about you? Do you have jet lag?
So I missed you last week. I'm sorry I missed it. Great interview that you did on an important issue.
Thank you. Lee was amazing.
You know, I had jet lag coming back. Yeah, I find it hard to go to bed at a reasonable hour. I had that problem before. It's exacerbated by the trip. It was nice to be out there.
I can always fly from here out to the West Coast. You know, I grew up in Los Angeles, so I go home to see family. I can make the flight out, no problem. It's the flight coming back east that knocks me out and throws my time clock off.
Yeah, the same happened with me.
Yeah.
I mean, I like going from east to west. You gain time. I end up getting up earlier. I was on time for everything. I managed to have breakfast a couple of days with friends and colleagues. So I like that. Then you come back and it's terrible. So we need to talk fast.
Really?
So, you know, we record at home. I record at home in the basement of my house. And as I was mentioning before we started recording, our kitchen sink no longer works. There's a leak. And it hasn't worked for 3 days. And between 8 and 12 Tuesday morning is when the plumbers can come. Let's try to get through some of this legal material before the plumbers show up.
And if not, maybe we can have the plumbers join us as special guests.
Maybe. We can talk about, you know, the Watergate plumbers. So on that note, let's return to a topic we've talked about the last number of weeks, and that's the issue of reproductive rights and abortion. You and I have spent a good amount of time talking about this Texas law, SB 8, the Supreme Court's reaction to SB 8, basically letting it proceed. Then we talked a couple of weeks ago about the fact that there are at least three plaintiffs who have taken advantage of the sort of mercenary aspect of that law to sue a doctor who admitted himself publicly that he had performed an abortion. We'll see what's happening with those things. But there's been another development in connection with that case because DOJ has gotten involved and has sued the state with respect to that law, SB 8.
So there was a hearing on Friday in that lawsuit. And if you feel like you're having deja vu, it's because this is a very similar sort of proceeding to the one that ended up in the Supreme Court that led to the Supreme Court refusing to enjoin SB 8 and letting it go into effect in the lawsuit that was brought by Texas abortion providers and advocates. This is round two in the DOJ lawsuit. They're in front of the district judge in Texas, Preet's and my former colleague, Robert Pittman. And at this point, DOJ is asking Judge Pittman to enjoin the law. So the same ask that was earlier made and ultimately refused by the Supreme Court, now being made by DOJ on a slightly different basis because DOJ comes into court with different equities and obligations. And in this hearing on Friday, Preet, I think the most interesting thing that happened is that Judge Pittman really pushed the state. And he said, if the state is so confident in the constitutionality of the limitations on a woman's access to abortion, then why did it go to such great lengths to create this very unusual private enforcement mechanism? In other words, Texas, why can't you just enforce this law, SB 8, like you would enforce any other law? And I particularly loved, Preet, the response that the lawyer for the state, an attorney named Will Thompson, gave to the judge. He said, I don't think the state went to particularly unusual lengths. So now Judge Pittman will have to decide whether or not to enjoin the law.
Yeah, I mean, what the hearing kind of crystallized is the craziness of this regime and how sort of they tie themselves up in knots or in a pretzel or whatever metaphor you prefer to prevent there from being relief. I mean, the whole argument here was in part on the one side, the DOJ side, asserting that what Texas has done is to create an unprecedented scheme of, in their words, vigilante justice designed to scare abortion providers. And then the Texas lawyers say, among other things, well, that's hyperbole. You're going too far. You know, it wasn't a big deal. It's not that unusual, but of course it is. And also to say, and this goes to the cleverness of the scheme, you don't enjoin a law. You don't stop a law. You enjoin or stop people from doing things. And here, you're trying to stop the wrong folks because the state is not enforcing this thing. And the question, it's almost a philosophical question, given the cleverness of the scheme, who is it that you're trying to enjoin? You can't do the action that you're doing here. You can't seek the relief that you're seeking here. They say to DOJ, because you don't have the proper target for your injunction. So too clever by half again? Or is there some possibility that the cleverness of it will prevail?
It seems to me that the comment that you made the first time we discussed this case is the comment that has to be the North Star in this conversation. The whole reason that we have a legal system is so people can enforce their rights. And Texas, you know, I prefer to think of this as evil genius. I don't want to give them points for being clever. I think what they're trying to do here is to come up with a way to avoid the legal system, and that seems to me to be more evil than genius. But ultimately, what that pushes me to conclude, and I suspect this is where Judge Pittman is headed based on some of the questions he reportedly asked, is to conclude that what Texas has done is it has converted private individuals into state actors. And it should be possible, and DOJ makes this argument, to enjoin the Texas courts from letting these legal proceedings against the clinics proceed. You could enjoin at a lot of different places. You know, you could force the courts to decline the cases. You could enjoin the courts from letting the cases proceed. You could enjoin judges from pursuing individual cases. So I think that there are some options here. I love that the lawyer from Texas told the judge in this regard, this is not some kind of vigilante scheme. It uses the normal lawful process of justice in Texas. And that's nuts, right? Because this is literally a vigilante justice system and something that a court properly should enjoin using the mechanisms that it has available to it.
I wonder if you think the following argument made by Texas, lawyers for Texas, if the argument is evil genius or clever or some other thing. One of the things you have to prove or make a substantial showing of in order to get a preliminary injunction is irreparable harm. And that is essentially a finding that, you know, remember the analogy we used with respect to my house, you know, who owns the house? Well, if you let, and there, cue the plumbers. The plumbers are here.
Such perfect timing.
You know, it never fails, right? You, the cable guy and the plumbers, right? You get a four-hour window and they will show up at the most inconvenient moment in the window. I think that's actually in the Constitution. So irreparable harm is a showing that in the analogy of my house, if you tear down the house and you ultimately say, well, it was Preet's house and it shouldn't have been torn down, it's a little too late and there's been irreparable harm. So here, DOJ is saying, among other things, that law irreparably injures the United States by restricting the operations and responsibilities of the federal government. It doesn't allow people at the Bureau of Prisons and other places, as we've discussed before, from performing abortion services as the law permits and requires them to in proper circumstances, right? So if you let us do it, that's irreparable harm. Texas, in response, says, well, I don't know what you're talking about. That's a silly argument because even if you win, it's just a preliminary injunction. And we'll still fight in the courts about whether or not there'll be ultimately a permanent injunction. So the chilling effect on abortion providers that exists now, because SB 8 is allowed to continue unfettered, will remain the case because there will not be finality and closure on SB 8 because it will only be a preliminary injunction, not a permanent injunction. Now, so if I haven't put everyone to sleep with this legal mumbo jumbo, maybe you can explain whether that's clever or not.
What that argument does is I think it assumes that the Supreme Court is going to reverse Roe versus Wade. Roe versus Wade won't be good law after the Supreme Court decides Dobbs, the Mississippi case. And there's also another piece of this argument that I find to be really troubling. It has to do with a provision in the Texas law. The Texas law permits lawsuits to be brought retroactively. In other words, if the court were to grant an injunction and keep SB 8 from going into place, and women were to proceed with obtaining reproductive services, and then later on the injunction was dissolved and SB 8 again became the law in Texas, maybe because the Supreme Court has reversed or gutted Roe, Texas makes the argument that there would be a four-year period in which private vigilante citizens could bring lawsuits in Texas to enforce the law against women. And so the argument it's essentially making is that there is no irreparable injury to women's rights and to DOJ's rights and obligations if the law remains in effect, because ultimately, there's this lengthy four-year period, and women's rights will ultimately be denied and the lawsuits will take place anyhow. In other words, to your point, the argument proves far too much about Texas's intent here.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And it's such a weird thing for us to be discussing a central issue in our law for decades and decades, settled precedent from Roe v. Wade up to Planned Parenthood v. Casey and beyond. And all of this discussion and argument is about legal strategy and who has standing and who is the human who can be enjoined or not enjoined. It's really a matter of the tail wagging the dog. And that's where sometimes, as I said at the outset of this conversation a few weeks ago, people get upset and angry about the law. And they say it doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, the buildings are upside down. And I just wonder what you think of this argument. The Texas folks say, look, this issue of who can sue and who can't sue and whether they're standing or not standing is not really a big problem because they say the constitutionality of the Heartbeat Act, that's SB 8, can be reviewed in the same way that virtually all of state tort law is. State court defendants raise constitutional defenses before neutral judges sworn to follow the U.S. Constitution and, if necessary, appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And they say nobody has a right to be in federal court, and federal court has different rules relating to standing and who can be enjoined versus state court. Is there any fairness to that argument?
You know, federal law says that there can't be a death penalty for any crimes other than murder. And Alabama is a state where there's a lot of support for using the death penalty. So maybe Alabama should go ahead and pass a statute that says that there can be a death penalty for crimes like robbery and assault and rape, but it won't be execution by the state. It'll be execution by private vigilantes who can go in and execute people. And if you want to challenge that law, DOJ, you can go and challenge it in Alabama state court. I think that's my answer to that argument.
Wow. If I could do orally a fire emoji, I would.
Look, I think the problem here, and you've said this before, is that we are trying to engage in a responsible way and look at the arguments and think about whether they make sense. But ultimately, at some point, you just have to call something BS when it is and say that this is an effort to abuse the legal system, to deny people rights of 50 years standing. The Supreme Court is going to do whatever it's going to do this term, but making a mockery of the legal system like Texas has done is something that needs to be challenged and called out.
I agree with that. Now, you mentioned the Mississippi case. Maybe we spend a minute addressing the issue of whether or not this Texas back and forth even matters when you have a Mississippi case where that state has openly and notoriously and directly called for the overruling of Roe, and the Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case in, you know, just a few weeks. Isn't that the case that's going to settle everything on the issue of Roe's survival, and this Texas stuff is just a sideshow? Or does the Texas case still matter?
There are a lot of people who hope that the Supreme Court will outright reverse Roe in Dobbs. And Mississippi has certainly postured that case, so that's one possible outcome, because the issue is whether states can impose pre-viability restrictions on obtaining abortion. The Mississippi law permits the state to do that from 15 weeks on. It's a ban on abortions after the 15th week, and so it sets that issue up. The cynic in me, and this is more in your wheelhouse than mine, but the cynic in me says it's awfully dangerous to reverse Roe going into an election year. Typical wisdom is that the party that's out of the White House makes gains in the midterm election. Mobilizing American women who lose abortion rights outright could have political consequences. Not certainly, but it could.
Wait, Joyce. The Supreme Court is not political.
No, I know that they're not, but theoretically, if they were, they might consider some of these things, and there might be some folks on the court or even some of the advocates in the case who would encourage an approach that would be more approximate to what the court did to voting rights in Shelby County, where they didn't outright say that the Voting Rights Act was unconstitutional. They just gutted it. It would be possible to issue a more narrow holding in Dobbs that would essentially give states far more of an ability to restrict abortion, but would deny people who might want to use it for political purposes the headline that Roe versus Wade had been overturned. Too cynical?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I go back to a point you and I have made before. That's very odd to me, although when you think about it, it's not so odd. There's a subset of folks in this country who I disagree with, you know, really, really, really strongly. But there's a subset of folks in this country who have a genuine belief that life begins at conception or soon thereafter. And abortion, in most circumstances, is tantamount to murder. And they have that genuine conviction. And I don't have that belief, and you don't have that belief. And I think science and law and philosophy are more on the side of reasonable abortion provision. But if you do have that belief, you would think, I think some members of the Supreme Court have that belief, if you do have that, you would think you would be celebrating in the streets some of the decisions that have occurred along the way with respect to the Texas statute, SB 8. And instead, the people who have that belief, or the leaders of people who have that belief, seem to be going out of their way to tamp it down and not celebrate and not say it's a real blow for their in favor of their cause. Why? Because the politics of it.
The dog is catching the car and it's a little bit worried about what it's going to do with it now.
Yeah, I mean, you would think there would be, you know, a different kind of chorus of celebration and happiness on the part of people who want Roe overturned. And yet it's very quiet. And that quiet is very telling.
Well, I'll just say that I hope that if they do reverse Roe, all of those states will immediately bring forth into their legislatures laws designed to provide for prenatal care and for expansion of Medicaid and for early childhood education and for child care for women, for moms who are working. Because if you're really pro-life, not just pro-birth, we would need those laws to go along with that. But I'm not holding my breath.
So we'll keep an eye on everything going on with Texas and Mississippi and reproductive rights in the United States, such as they are and will be. There have been other developments, Joyce, with respect to the January 6th panel in the House of Representatives, led by Congressman Benny Thompson. There have been subpoenas issued. You know, we love to talk about subpoenas. There were, in recent days, subpoenas issued to four Trump advisors, Mr. Meadows, Mr. Bannon, Mr. Kash Patel, and Mr. Scavino. We can get to that in a moment. But more recently, there have been subpoenas issued for deposition testimony and documents from 11 people, most of whom were listed on paperwork for the January 6th rally. Most of these people are not household names. You've never heard of many of them. You know, you have those four significant and well-known Trump advisors in the first phase, but in the second phase, you have these people who are sort of on the ground and a position to have had communications between and among themselves, but also between and among folks at the White House. One person is the most well-known of the 11, Katrina Pearson, a former Trump campaign official, is cited as being someone who had direct communication with Donald Trump about the rallies. And if one of the ultimate goals of the panel's inquiry is to figure out the state of mind and the intent of Donald Trump, was he really intending to just engage in normal political protected speech? Or was he trying to interfere unlawfully with the proper traditional counting of votes in the Congress? Testimony like this can make the difference. And it also strikes me that they're going about it the right sort of measured way, that they're taking deposition testimony behind closed doors. They're trying to get all the documents together. They're not only trying as an initial matter to get high-profile, blockbuster-type witnesses, but, you know, what in lots of investigations are the bread and butter, shoe leather work of an inquiry to find out what lots and lots of people at lower levels have to say so they can build up a narrative of what happened from the ground up. They're not immediately parading people before a committee with television cameras and everything else. They're doing basic investigation, interviewing, testimony taking, document review, and then later we'll see what they have put together and what dots they've connected for public hearings. Does that sound right to you?
I think that's right. This is what happens when you've got professional prosecutors working with congressional representatives, many of whom have prosecutorial chops themselves, and they focus on the right questions. Because It seems to me that one of the biggest questions that has to be answered here is why Trump wanted to move the mob from the Ellipse to the Capitol. I mean, what were they supposed to achieve that they hadn't already done? He'd had this stirring rally in front of the Ellipse with all of his speakers. What was left to do? And the problem that we have, I think, as a society is we all assume that we know the answer to that question. It's important to let the committee develop the evidence. And that's why this process looks so very functional to me. There's an interesting question buried inside of these subpoenas to the 11, this second batch of subpoenas. There are obviously a lot of good reasons for issuing these subpoenas. Many of these people are listed as having important roles connected with the rally on the Ellipse. They were folks involved in getting the permit, in organizing, VIP coverage, all those sort of things. But there's also been a reference in the reporting that some of these women in this group called Women for America First were developing concerns about Ali Alexander. Alexander is the founder of the Stop the Steal movement, and he was beginning to talk about organizing a movement towards the Capitol. And some of these women, the reporting suggests, developed concerns. They feared his online promotion. They thought he was stoking something dangerous. He was using chance of victory or death. And the question that could legitimately be asked of these folks pursuant to their subpoenas is, did they share those concerns with the White House? And what was the White House's response? I think that's a rich area for inquiry.
No, I think it's incredibly important. I mean, some of these people will have testimony that suggests they were complicit and they wanted to engage in bad conduct and reverse the vote. And others, it looks from the subpoena paperwork, were in a position to have raised red flags and alarm bells that there are people like Alexander and others who wanted to go far beyond what the permit allowed in terms of peaceful protest. The most important thing to me, and I've been saying this since just after January 6th and the insurrection took place, is what was in Donald Trump's mind. His defense, politically, optically, potentially at some point in the future, legally, is he was just engaging in ordinary speech. This is going to be relevant to the lawsuits that have been brought against him, potential criminal prosecution, although I don't hold out hope for that. Was he just doing what is protected for a president, exercising his First Amendment right, and, you know, giving a pep talk to his supporters? Or was he actually causing them, inciting them to do something that was unlawful, to interfere with the workings of Congress and to interfere with the unfolding tally of votes in connection with a momentous election? And you can't really understand the answer to that question unless you know what it is he was saying and thinking and doing, and whether he was proceeding knowing that there was violence taking place. And, you know, we have incidental evidence of this because we have some of his public comments when he said, "I love you." But he and his allies also point to the fact, you know, that's almost a footnote in his talk from January 6th. He says something about, you know, demonstrate peacefully. But then every other thing he said, including all the stuff leading up to that moment, was in the service of not just talk, but actually reversing the election. We know that he exhorted Mike Pence to do the thing that even Dan Quayle said you couldn't do, which is not certify the vote. We know, for example, you know, this I find interesting with respect to the first group of folks, including Mark Meadows, former representative and former chief of staff to President Trump, that the Select Committee, the January 6th Select Committee, is not only seeking his testimony and documents relating to things that happened on January 6th and the rally and the violent attack on the Capitol, but also the series of phone calls he's reported to have made to people at the top of the Justice Department to get them to engage in inappropriate action in Georgia and elsewhere. So all this stuff is tied together. It's not just about what happened January 6th, the insurrection. It's all tied up with, and I'm glad the committee believes it to be tied up with, all these other things they did with the Department of Justice and the Georgia election officials and other places to try to undo the election.
What I'm looking for with these witnesses, if I'm a prosecutor, is a smoking gun. Because as you say, Trump's state of mind is really important. And so when you've got a witness like Katrina Pearson, who was Trump's national spokesman during the 2016 campaign, then she went to the C4 after the election, And on her subpoena request, it suggests that she had in-person conversations with Trump in advance of January 6th. So here's what I'm looking for. There's that self-serving statement that you identify in the speech on the Ellipse about, you know, be peaceful. I'm looking for, was there a conversation where someone said, we need to make sure that we insert this line into the speech so we can refer back to it? There's probably not something as bold and as blatant as that, but Pearson may have had conversations where Trump literally said what was on his mind, literally talked about the importance of preventing Congress from certifying Biden's election victory. And that's what prosecutors and Congress is looking for here.
So I think the question that everyone is waiting for us to get to is, do these folks have to comply with the subpoenas, and what basis do they have to not comply? So we should take the two groups separately for a moment. So you have Meadows, Bannon, Cash, Patel, Scavino. Three of those four were in governmental positions at the time of the conduct that's being inquired about, and the communications took place. One of them, Steve Bannon, I don't know what basis at all. Steve Bannon, who was a private citizen at the time, and by the way, was under indictment in the Southern District of New York, later pardoned inexcusably, to my mind, by the former president. I don't know what argument of executive privilege or anything else Steve Bannon can make. Now, the other three...
It's more like a criminal conspiracy than it is like executive privilege if he and Trump had a conversation and he wants to say he doesn't have to testify.
I agree with that, but I'm just saying, what straight-faced argument are lawyers for these people going to make? And we can... today and in future weeks, talk about executive privilege and how that works and what the back and forth is and what the negotiation is over that. But certainly Meadows, Cash, Scavino, and Bannon to a lesser degree will not want to cooperate, will not want to come in, will throw up the roadblock of executive privilege, even if it does not, you know, sit well within understood parameters of executive privilege because of the reasons you cite and others. But then you have these other 11 folks who were on the permit paperwork, you know, one or more of whom worked in the government, like Maggie Mulvaney, who I think was the niece of Mick Mulvaney. And you'll get into a weird back and forth and litigation over whether or not the House can subpoena one of its own people, someone who works in the House, whether a member or a staff member. But these other private citizens who were engaging in preparation for the rally, before we get to how the subpoenas can be enforced, what's the basis on which some of these folks are going to say, nah, rather not come in?
So this will, if they challenge the subpoenas, be like so much of what we saw during the Trump administration, where there's some sort of specious privilege or immunity asserted, and the purpose is delay. Ultimately, the legal theory is flawed, but they know that they can get into civil courts and delay their obligation to testify by doing that. One would hope, and we can talk about this as we get into enforcement, one would hope that the courts would be savvy to that by now.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
I mean, do you see anything legitimate that they can assert? I just don't.
I mean, I don't know that everyone's going to assert. And by the way, with respect to some of these folks, including the Trump advisors, there's a political cost to be paid for doing this, but it's legally protective to assert the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
Preet, only the guilty take the Fifth Amendment. Trump himself has said that.
I know, you're quoting Trump. You don't actually believe that. He has said that with respect to other folks who are in a position to incriminate him, that if you invoke the Fifth Amendment, you're doing that because you must be guilty. He didn't spend a lot of time studying any law. But look, some of these folks might want to come in, right? Because they don't want this hanging over their heads. And some of them are in the position to give testimony about red flags. And some of them maybe are appalled by what happened on January 6th. I don't know enough about these 11 people. We'll learn more about them as time goes by and what their lawyers assert. But some of them may come in. I think the people closer to Trump will never want to come in.
Who knows, though? Maybe a Steve Bannon, who really seems intent on burning the whole house down, might want to come in and answer some questions and say, what are you going to do about it now?
He wants his Oliver North moment.
I mean, he seems to be in a very unusual, aggressive, and openly talking about it posture. So
deranged.
I wonder if he might not be the one. Yeah, deranged is good. I wouldn't rule out the possibility, although I don't think it's a high percentage chance, that he might show up with whatever his crazy agenda is.
So now we're getting to the big question, right? That I get asked, you get asked, that everyone gets asked. And it's because we say we're a nation of laws, not men. And we say no one is above the law. And we say Congress has power and there's a judiciary that has power. And a properly issued subpoena cannot just be defied. There has to be some consequence for that. And as an introductory point, I will say you're right to feel irritation and frustration about how sometimes that doesn't play out. There is a big difference between subpoenas that you and I issued or authorized when we were U.S. attorneys, where you have a lot of power and force and authority in the courts, and you have a cadre of agents, whether it's police officers or FBI agents or DEA agents, who can help enforce these things. And there's a long tradition, you know, every day in federal courts around the country and in state courts around the country with respect to DA's subpoenas, there's litigation over the scope of subpoenas and whether or not they can be enforced. And contempt is something that happens not uncommonly, and people go to prison for defying criminal subpoenas, grand jury subpoenas. These subpoenas are not grand jury subpoenas, and they're a bit, you know, frankly, weaker. And they have less of a track record, and there's a lot more negotiation about them, because especially when there's a fight between co-equal branches of government, you have one branch of government, the Congress, trying to get information from another branch of government, the executive. It's not as easy as when you and I issued subpoenas for bank records in connection with a money laundering investigation. And so I commend to folks' attention, you and I were talking about this, Ellie Honig, our colleague, wrote a great piece for CAFE where he basically lays out in some detail and entertainingly the possibilities of how you can enforce a subpoena. So the possible ways to enforce, and then, Joyce, let me know what you think about them. One is Congress itself, using its inherent power, could try to enforce the subpoenas. Second, they could go to the courts, the federal courts, to enforce the subpoenas. Third, they can make a criminal referral to the Department of Justice, headed by Merrick Garland, and they can bring a criminal case for the purpose of enforcing the subpoenas. Any of those going to fly?
Well, Ellie is genius, like he always is. This is one of my favorite reasons that I'm a CAFE subscriber and have been since long before we did the podcast together, because I like to read the notes. And Ellie here, I think, is just accurate and dead on the money about the enforcement options for these subpoenas. He is very quick to dismiss this notion that Congress can use its own inherent enforcement authority. That's something that people talked a lot about during the two Trump impeachments. Well, the marshal of the House can just go out and arrest
people. The sergeant at arms,
thank you, can go out
and jail.
Arrest people and put them in this non-existent jail in the Capitol, right? The point that Ellie makes, and it's correct, is that Congress has left this power dormant for more than 100 years. It may have had force at some point. It no longer does. An effort to use this to resurrect this power would be tied up in endless litigation, and nobody benefits from delay here, right? The whole goal is to elicit evidence while it's fresh and relevant.
Can we just pause on that for a moment? Because we've said that a couple of times, and just spell out why delay is a problem. You know, with the Mueller investigation, my view always was that Bob Mueller keeps his head down, and some people are not happy with what the outcome was, but he keeps his head down. He did what he needed to do. He didn't have to end his role when he did. I think he wanted to sort of do the investigation, get out, and not come anywhere close to the election. He wanted to be done and then, you know, leave the work behind for other people, some of which got scuttled by Bill Barr and others. And here, there's no law or statute that says it needs to conclude by some particular moment, right? There's not even a statute of limitations here, because they're just doing an inquiry that doesn't have criminal force behind it. It's the pragmatic clock of the next election and how it will look for the committee to be inquiring into this stuff as we approach the midterm. So do you agree that there's a political clock?
There is, but I'm not sure it's necessarily bad for people who want to learn the truth about January 6th, because remember, Republicans walked away from a deal that would have included a bipartisan committee whose work would have had to have concluded by the end of this calendar year. They bypassed that deal. And if this committee's work goes close to the election season because Republicans delay and don't comply with subpoenas and won't turn over documents, then I think the committee has a good argument for continuing its work without regard to the next election, because the truth matters. But as you say, there is a political cost for doing that, and Republicans will cry witch hunt again.
Right. So I interrupted you. So the first method of enforcement is the sergeant at arms. Congress does it itself.
Not happening.
So the next is the courts. What's wrong with that?
So civil enforcement is a great mechanism, but we all remember that it too failed during impeachment. For one thing, it took Congress a long time to get into court with those subpoenas. I don't think that we'll see that happen again. I think that if the committee realizes it has to go the civil enforcement route, it will be quick to get into court, and it will hope that courts will rule expeditiously. But expeditiously in a legal system where you have to deal with important issues of executive privilege and other types of immunity doesn't mean in a couple of days or in a week. And even if district courts rule quickly, there is appeal to the Court of Appeals and perhaps ultimately to the Supreme Court. So this is a strategy that means we're looking at answers that could take, you know, a long time,
many,
right?
Many months.
I mean, maybe even more than months, because Don McGahn, who gets subpoenaed, we don't have a resolution of that issue and testimony by McGahn until after the Trump administration has ended. I mean, that's the potential sort of delay we're looking at. So civil enforcement is a possibility, but it raises all of the privilege issues for litigation, and it could take too long.
Do you agree that they have to give that a shot? You can't just let it go. If inherent authority and the sergeant at arms, you know, taking cuffs to the intransigent witness is not a possibility, notwithstanding the flaws and the delays, you got to get into court.
You
got to start that process.
So
I think we're going to see that,
yeah.
Whether or not it results in anything tangible on a quick time frame, that's a separate question. And then finally, it's angering to folks if you have a legitimate subpoena and it relates to an inquiry that's really, really, really important to the sort of stability of democracy in America or instability of it. They should come and testify, just like any of the people that we issued subpoenas to in our prior jobs had to testify. Otherwise, there's a consequence. And here, there happens to be a law that criminalizes defiance of a congressional subpoena. How serious is that crime, Joyce? It was a carry, like a life imprisonment, 20 years?
What so is it's it? A misdemeanor.
Oh, it's a misdemeanor.
But it's a very unusual misdemeanor, right? Most misdemeanors don't involve any imposition of jail time. This misdemeanor has a mandatory minimum of 30 days. Now, I'm sure Steve Bannon can do 30 days
standing on his head.
Yeah, absolutely. But nonetheless, there are some teeth to this criminal contempt. The big question is whether DOJ would bring criminal contempt cases to enforce these subpoenas.
Well, they haven't in the past.
They have not. They have never dealt with the situation involving an insurrection and the possible interference with the smooth transfer of political power in this country. But that, of course, difference has animated all of DOJ's process with these cases. And DOJ still seems to show a real lack of appetite to engage in a process that could be deemed political. I think that that's regrettable. And here's my point of view. When I issued subpoenas to people who really didn't want to come and testify in front of my grand jury, often they were worried that people who were involved in the matter might, you know, exact some form of retribution against them. They were worried about their safety or the safety of their family. They had to come and testify. As you said, we always had the possibility that the United States Marshal would go out and put bracelets on them and bring them in to testify involuntarily if they wouldn't show up pursuant to that subpoena. I don't understand why we can expect just average citizens to be more compliant with the justice system than we expect of these people who had taken oaths to uphold the Constitution, these first four. They had all been political appointees at some point. They had all taken that oath. Why they don't have to live up to it is both beyond me and ultimately will have a really strong negative impact on the rule of law in this country if they're able to avoid testifying.
I'm going to restate a principle that doesn't necessarily apply in this case, although I think it does. And it's a mode of argumentation that I find silly and not quite up to the moments that we've been experiencing. And it's something like this. You know, critics of some action by the government, whether it's seeking criminal contempt in response to defiance of subpoenas, or, you know, some vaccination mandate or some masking policy, will say that's an extraordinary thing for the government to do. It's unprecedented. It's really draconian or crazy because it hasn't been done in 100 years or ever. And that may or may not be true, But the counterargument to that is that in almost every instance that you and I talk about it, if it's important enough for us to talk about it, those are actions that are being taken in response to equally, if not more serious, unprecedented, dramatic events, namely a once-in-a-century pandemic or a once-in-a-country's-lifetime insurrection at the Capitol. So when Merrick Garland and others in policymaking positions in the executive branch or in Congress think about the necessity of taking extraordinary steps, they have to do that in the context of what extraordinary thing they're addressing. Those two things are not separated from each other. They're not distinct from each other, right?
The question is, what does your oath to the Constitution require you to do in unprecedented times? You know, Abe Lincoln lived in unprecedented times and did unprecedented things. We face similar challenges in this moment, and I think it doesn't require that people be shrinking violets who are overly obsessed with concerns about appearing to be apolitical. It requires people to make difficult decisions. It doesn't require you to be a go-along to get along or to hope that people will like you or like your decisions. You simply have to do the right thing.
So Joyce, this is now so let me do a very artful segue from the January 6th committee to best dog breeds. We asked folks, because you're considering getting another dog, and our fine listeners who care a lot about you and about your family's happiness and about dogs generally, sent in a bunch of suggestions with also, by the way, very cute pictures. Have you seen this? You have a view? Have you been persuaded by any of these listener suggestions?
I have. And first, let me say, I loved everybody who took the time to respond and to tweet, and especially the people who included pictures of their dogs. I killed several hours that I should have been spending preparing lectures for my students looking at pictures of dogs and had to work into the wee hours, and it was worth every minute of it. I wouldn't take it back. So here's the state of play in the Vance household. We have two dogs. We had an older dog, a wonderful stray dog who was named Trouble. She grew to deserve that name.
But good
she
Trouble?
Was the sweetest, oh my God, good Trouble, the sweetest, best dog we've ever had. And her time with us came to an end. We have our German Shepherd, Bella, and our boxer, Fig. My husband is on the warpath to get a third dog. And that's not unusual for Bob. He grew up in a household where his mom actually was a dog breeder. He grew up with Great Danes and with Salukis, and he was used to having a lot of dogs around. And Bob has a practice when he wants a new puppy of getting me a dog for a birthday or for Christmas.
Do you have a birthday coming up?
Our anniversary is in 4 days.
Okay.
So what are the odds, right? So... Here are some of the dogs that our readers suggested, and they're great suggestions. First off, a border collie. My mother-in-law got me a border collie to celebrate the birth of our oldest child. The border collie was named Dandy, and she was not just the smartest dog in the house, she was actually the smartest person in the house. She used to herd everybody and run circles around us.
I should say that suggestion comes from Greg. I want to give credit to the folks.
It does come from Greg. And Greg makes the point that this is the best farm dog. And that's true because our Dandy lived out most of her life on a farm where she was very happy herding sheep. Not a dog for people who live in the city like us. But thank you, Greg. I love border collies. Antonia suggested a Great Pyrenees puppy. Love that breed. They're huge and we're big dog people. And then Susie suggested a Labrador Retriever. Susie, that may be the dog that Bob comes home with. Our first dog was a lab pup named Tori, a black lab who we loved. So we may be headed back that direction. I love these suggestions so much. And when there's a new dog in the Vance family, we'll definitely share that news and photos.
I can't wait. So we're monitoring all this, including what dog will next become a part of the Vance household. We'll be back next Tuesday. So send your questions and also further dog breed suggestions to letters@cafe.com.
We look forward to answering them.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Chris Boylan, and Sean Walsh. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.